Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I want to start today's conversation with a feeling that I think pretty much everyone listening has had, probably in the last 24 hours.
Oh, yeah.
It's that feeling you get when you're just, you know, scrolling through your news feed or maybe walking through a university campus.
Mm-hmm.
You see a headline about quantum physics, something about, I don't know, entanglement or particles. And then you swipe up and there's a report on the stock market crashing.
And then something else completely different.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then another swipe, and it's a huge article about the mental health crisis in teenagers.
It can feel like intellectual whiplash.
That's the perfect word for it. It's this profound sense of fragmentation. We sort of implicitly believe that these are three completely different universes.
Right. Separate world.
We think the rules governing an atom have absolutely zero to do with the rules governing a bank run, which in turn have nothing at all to do with why you feel anxious on a Sunday night.
Mm. We treat them like they're on different planets. Physics is in the basement, economics is up on the top floor, and psychology is, I don't know, floating in the clouds somewhere.
Yeah, exactly, floating in the clouds. We treat reality like it's a series of just disconnected islands.
And we assume that because the vocabulary is different, you know, mass and velocity versus supply and demand versus dopamine and serotonin, that the underlying logic must be different too.
Right. It feels like we're living in this fractured reality where you need, what, five different PhDs just to get a handle on how the world fits together. But today, we are diving into a document that says, basically, no, that is a lie.
A pretty provocative starting point.
It is. We're looking at a white paper. It's titled A Single Grammar Across Scale.
Mm-hmm.
And it was written by Dr. Bechara Saheeli, who's an internal medicine specialist, along with his AI research partner, ChatGPT 5.2.
And that partnership itself is something we should probably flag right away.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. You have a human synthesizer working with a massive pattern recognition engine, and they're trying to see the whole in a way that's, well, it's really hard for a single human brain to do.
It's a grand unified theory, but not in the way physicists usually mean it. They aren't trying to find one equation for gravity and electromagnetism.
No, no, it's much broader than that.
They are trying to find the source code for existence itself. The bold claim here is that there aren't separate worlds. There is a strictly ordered hierarchy of layers, all obeying a single viability grammar.
That's the core premise. The paper argues that reality isn't a blank check. You can't just, you know, build whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
There is a logic, a grammar, that dictates what allows a system to exist and to persist. They call this viability.
Okay.
And conversely, the same grammar dictates what makes a system collapse. And the fascinating, maybe slightly terrifying part is that this grammar is the same all the way up and all the way down.
So you're saying whether we are talking about a single cell, a human brain,
mm-hmm.
or the entire Roman Empire, the rules of survival are identical.
Identical. The specific mechanisms change, of course. A cell uses proteins, a society uses laws.
Great different tools.
But the grammar, the structural logic of how those things relate to keep the system alive is exactly the same.
Okay. Before we get into the specific layers, and I think there are six of them, and we were going to go deep on every single one, we have to define this word grammar. Because mm-hmm. when I hear grammar, I think of like eighth grade English class.
Yeah, red ink everywhere.
Totally. I think of getting a red ink mark because I put a comma in the wrong place.
And that's actually a perfect place to start, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah. Think about what language grammar actually does. Grammar doesn't tell you what to say. It doesn't order you to write a love sonnet or a grocery list. You have total freedom in the content.
Okay, I'm with you.
But it dictates the constraints. It tells you the structural rules that make a sentence intelligible rather than just, you know, random noise.
So if I just started shouting random syllables like glarb floop zibber, I'm violating the grammar of English.
Exactly. And because you violated the grammar, your message collapses. It fails to be a message. It just becomes noise.
Mm.
Now, zoom out and apply that to existence itself. A viability grammar isn't a mechanism. It's not a blueprint telling the universe exactly what to build. It is a set of constraints. It says, if you want to exist and if you want to keep existing, you must satisfy these conditions.
And what happens if you violate them?
Well, that's the difference between English class and the universe. In English class, you get a bad grade. In the universe, if you violate the grammar of viability, you dissolve. You cease to be.
So the penalty is existential.
It is.
That is distinct.
Yes.
So this is not a metaphor. They aren't saying life is like grammar. They are saying it is a grammar.
No, absolutely not a metaphor. And the authors are very, very clear on that. This isn't poetry. They're saying these are structural facts. Reality just filters out anything that doesn't follow the rules.
Okay, that definitely sets the stakes. We aren't just talking about some nice philosophy of life. We're talking about the raw mechanics of survival. So let's lay out the roadmap for this deep dive. The paper outlines what it calls a master sequence. It's a hierarchy of six layers.
The whole ladder.
Yeah, the whole ladder. I'm going to just list them so we have a map, and then we're going to walk through them one by one.
Let's do it.
Okay, here's the sequence. Layer one, invariance constrained matter.
The bedrock.
Layer two, energy and axe constraints. Layer three, effect fields viability.
Mm-hmm.
Layer four, cognition buffers risk. Layer five, culture symbolizes regulation. And then finally, layer six, ethics names limits.
It's a beautiful sequence, really. And the key theme you have to keep in mind as we walk through this is that each higher layer like cognition or culture exists to buffer the layers below it.
What do you mean by buffer?
They buy you time.
Bow.
But, and this is the crucial warning of the paper, the higher layers cannot override the lower layers indefinitely. You can't think your way out of starvation. You can't legislate your way out of physics.
I love that concept of buffering versus overriding.
What?
We are definitely going to come back to that because I feel like that is where modern society is getting into a lot of trouble.
I think you're right.
But let's start at the bedrock. Layer one, invariance constrained matter.
Right. The foundation.
Now, invariant is a heavy physics word. It sounds very, very technical. What does it actually mean in this context?
It simply means reality isn't a blank check.
Okay.
You can't just arrange matter however you want and expect it to stay that way. An invariant is a relationship that remains stable over time. So think about a dinner party.
A dinner party. Okay, I'm with you. Let's do it.
Imagine you have 10 people. Uncle Bob hates Aunt Linda. The cousin can't sit next to the ex-girlfriend. You don't necessarily have a goal to make a pretty shape at the table. You just have constraints.
Right. Don't start a fight.
Exactly. If you put Bob next to Linda, the arrangement falls apart. There's an argument. Someone leaves. It's unstable.
So the seating chart is just whatever arrangement doesn't result in an explosion.
Exactly. Now bring that down to the atomic level. Atoms don't have goals. An atom isn't sitting there thinking, you know what? I really want to become a water molecule today because I want to hydrate a runner.
Right. Atoms don't have ambition.
They don't. They have constraint satisfaction.
They just bump into each other and stick if they fit?
Pretty much. They fall into stable relationships because those are the only relationships that don't fall apart. Everything else dissolves. If a configuration of matter violates the laws of thermodynamics or quantum mechanics, it vanishes instantly. What's left, what we see as the universe, is just the stuff that found a way to be stable.
So survival's the default filter. We look around and say, wow, look at all this amazing structure, but we're only seeing the survivors. We aren't seeing the trillions upon trillions of arrangements that failed in a nanosecond.
Precisely. And here is a huge insight from the paper that I really want to pause on because it's a big one. Constraint comes before information.
Unpack that for me. Because we live in the information age, right? We tend to think that code creates reality. We think the DNA code creates the body or the blueprint creates the building. You're saying it's the opposite.
The paper argues that you can't have information until you have a structure stable enough to hold it. Think about it. Can you write a book on water?
On liquid water? No. The water moves. The ink disperses. The words would vanish before you even finish the sentence.
Exactly. To have information, to have a DNA code, a language, a culture, you first need a physical substrate stable enough to hold it. You need a rock, a piece of paper, a stable protein chain. The constraint, the stability, must exist before the information can be written on it.
That completely flips the script. We usually think, I have an idea, then I build a structure to hold it. You're saying, if you don't have stable structure, your idea is a ghost.
Yes. And this applies all the way up. You cannot have a culture until you have a stable society that can physically survive. You cannot have a mind until you have a stable body that can regulate its temperature. Constraint is the foundation of everything. If you lose the constraint, the information just evaporates.
That is a profound way to look at reality. It makes things feel a lot more fragile, honestly.
Right here.
It's a reminder that order isn't guaranteed. It has to be won.
And then that leads us directly to the second layer. Because rocks are stable, a diamond is very stable, it satisfies constraints perfectly, but a diamond isn't alive.
It just sits there.
Right. It doesn't die because it was never alive in the first place.
So how do we get from invariance constrained matter to the second layer? Energy and axe constraints. This is the jump to biology, right?
This is the jump. And the paper redefines energy in a way that I think changes how you look at life itself. Usually we think of energy as fuel, you know, like gas in a car.
Right. I need energy to run. I need energy to move. More energy equals more speed, more power.
But in this grammar, energy is defined as margin.
Margin?
Yes, margin. Think about the difference between a rock and a cell. A rock satisfies constraints passively. It surrenders to gravity. It surrenders to entropy. If you kick it, it moves, but it doesn't care. It has no internal drive to stay a rock.
Okay.
A cell is different. A cell is a structure that is constantly falling apart. It's highly unstable. It is fighting entropy every single millisecond. To stay a cell, it has to actively repair itself. It has to pump things in and out. That costs energy.
So life is basically just high maintenance matter.
That is a perfect way to put it. Life is renting exemption from entropy. You are paying an energetic cost to repair yourself faster than you break. You are buying time.
Wow.
And this introduces the most critical concept in the paper, one that applies to biology, economics, and everything else. The difference between viability and optimization.
Okay, this is a big theme. Viability versus optimization. I feel like we use these words interchangeably in business, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the paper says they're enemies.
They are often enemies. Yes. Optimization seeks the best possible outcome for a specific goal. It's all about efficiency, maximizing output, minimizing cost.
Getting the most bang for your buck.
Right. Viability asks a much more primal question. Can I continue?
Can I just keep playing the game? Not am I winning, but am I still in it?
Exactly. And here is the kicker. To be viable, you often have to sacrifice optimization. You need slack. You need margin.
Okay, give me an example.
Let's look at a supply chain. If you optimize a supply chain so perfectly that there is zero wasted space, zero extra inventory, and everything arrives just in time, you are incredibly efficient. Your costs are rock bottom. You are optimized.
But if one ship gets stuck in the Suez Canal,
the whole thing collapses. We've all seen that movie.
Oh, yeah.
That is a system with no margin. It optimized away its viability. Life generally doesn't do that. Biological systems keep extra capacity. You have two kidneys, even though you can live on one.
Right.
An optimizer would say, that's 50% waste. Cut the second kidney.
Which makes perfect sense on a spreadsheet until the first kidney fails.
Yeah.
And then you're dead.
Exactly. Nature optimizes for viability, which means redundancy. It means having margin to handle the bad day, the drought, the infection. So when the paper says energy enacts constraints, it means energy is used to build that buffer. Energy buys you the margin to be wrong or to be unlucky and still survive.
That feels like a direct shot at, I don't know, modern capitalism. Yeah. We've spent the last 40 years obsessing over efficiency, trimming the fat, lean manufacturing, lean staffing.
And the paper is saying, hey, that fat was actually your survival margin.
Yeah.
Precisely. When your energetic margin shrinks, your system becomes brittle. You might still look fine on the outside. Your stock price might be high, but you have lost the capacity to handle stress. You are one bad day away from collapse.
So energy isn't just go juice. Energy is the buffer against the unexpected.
Yes. And that brings us to the next problem. Even if you have energy, even if you have margin, how do you know when to use it? A cell needs to know when to repair itself, when to run, when to eat. It needs a control system.
Which brings us to layer three. Effect feels viability. Now, effect essentially means feeling or emotion. And I have to ask the big question, why do we feel? Why did evolution invent feelings? Why couldn't we just be smart robots that calculate survival?
This is where the lights come on in the House of Matter. This is my favorite part. The paper argues that effect feeling is a control signal for speed.
Speed. I usually think of my emotions as messy and actually slowing me down.
Think about it this way. Imagine you are a complex organism. You have billions of cells. You have energy levels, hydration levels, temperature, predators, social dynamics, all happening at once.
A lot of variables.
A ton. If you tried to calculate every single one to decide what to do, okay, wind speed is 10 knots, lion is 50 meters away, blood sugar is 80, you would be frozen. You'd be eaten before you finish the math.
You'd be stuck in calculating. Oh, I'm dead.
Exactly. This system is too complex for a spreadsheet. So nature invented a shortcut. A compression algorithm. It takes all that data, your blood sugar, the sight of a tiger, the smell of rain, and compresses it into a single global signal that screams danger or safe.
That's what a feeling is. It's a data compression.
That is what effect is. It's a viability report.
Yeah.
And the paper breaks it down into the minimal effective triad. Three basic things your feelings tell you.
Okay.
First, valence. Is this good or bad for my survival?
Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Exactly. Second, arousal. How urgent is it? Do I need to run now or can I deal with this later?
Got it.
And third, motivation. Do I approach or avoid?
That makes so much sense. You don't think pain, you feel it. Mm-hmm. And it commands you to stop doing whatever is causing it. You don't have to reason your way out of touching a hot stove.
Right. Your affect overrides your processing and just moves your hand. Affect is what viability constraints feel like from the inside. When you feel bad, structurally, biologically, it means your margin is shrinking. You are drifting toward the danger zone.
And when you feel good or secure, it means your margin is expanding.
You've got it. They are the ultimate instrument panel. We feel because we don't have infinite time or computing power. If we had infinite time, we could calculate everything, but we live in a dangerous world, so we need to feel.
Okay, so if feelings run the show, if they are the fast, efficient control system, why do we have these big brains? Why do we have layer 4? Cognition buffers risk. Because if feelings are so great, thinking seems almost redundant.
This is one of my favorite parts of the paper because it really flips the usual script. We usually think of our big brains as the CEO and our emotions as these, you know, primitive, messy things we need to suppress.
Right. The old don't be emotional, be rational.
Yeah.
Advice that never works.
It never works, the paper says. No. Cognition exists to buy time. It acts as a buffer for affect.
A buffer how? What does that mean?
If you operate only on affect, you are purely reactive. Something moves, you jump, you are hungry, you eat. That works, but it's risky. What if that food is poison? What if that movement was just the wind?
Right, you'd be jumping at shadows all day.
Cognition allows you to run a simulation. Instead of acting on the impulse immediately, you pause. You simulate a future. If I eat this berry, do I get sick? If I run now, does the lion see me?
So I can die in the simulation, so I don't have to die in real life.
That is the famous quote from Karl Popper. Our hypotheses die in our stead, and it's the absolute core of this layer. Cognition expands your optionality. It gives you choices. But, and this is a huge but, the paper argues that rational override is a luxury of safety.
Ooh, say more about that, the luxury of safety. I like that.
You can only afford to sit there and think, to simulate, to be rational when you have enough energetic and emotional margin. If a tiger is mid-pounce, you don't simulate. You revert to effect. You react.
This explains so much about human behavior. When we are stressed out, tired, or broke, we make bad decisions. But really, we're just making fast decisions because we lost the luxury of time.
Exactly. When you tell someone who is in a state of panic or starvation to just be rational, you are asking them to do something that is biologically impossible for them in that moment.
Wow.
Their margin is gone. The buffer has collapsed. They are back in the affect layer. Cognition requires a stable platform. You need to be safe enough to think.
So rationality isn't just some moral virtue, it's a biological privilege.
It is. And the paper points out a danger here too. Intelligence is a double-edged sword. It expands your options, yes, but it also expands your ability to make catastrophic errors.
How so?
A simple organism, like an amoeba, it can't make a mistake that destroys the world. It's too simple. But intelligence allows you to disconnect from reality. You can simulate futures that are complete delusions. You can talk yourself into things that violate your own biology.
You can rationalize eating the poison berry if you convince yourself it's actually a superfood.
Or
you can build a nuclear weapon.
Right. Intelligence allows you to create global financial derivatives that collapse the world economy. A dog couldn't do that. Intelligence allows for optimization without constraint. You can think your way into a trap that your feelings would have warned you against.
That is getting really deep. So cognition buffers risk, but if it gets untethered from the lower layers, from affect and biological reality, it creates new, massive risks of its own.
Exactly. The buffer becomes the threat.
Okay, so we've built up the individual mind. We have feelings. We have thoughts. But we don't live alone. We live in groups. Which brings us to layer 5. Culture symbolizes regulation.
This is where we connect individual brains to the collective. And think about it. No individual lives long enough to learn everything. If every baby had to relearn which mushrooms are poisonous, how to hunt, how to deliver a baby, how to treat a wound,
we'd be extinct.
The species would die out. We wouldn't make it past one generation.
We need an external hard drive.
Mm.
We need a way to pass the data down from one generation to the next.
Exactly. Culture is externalized buffering. It is the collective memory of what keeps us alive. It stores the viability constraints of the group. And the paper makes a really interesting point here about how it works. Rituals usually come before explanations.
What does that mean? Walk me through that.
We do tend to think that people, figure out the scientific truth of the universe and then they design rituals to celebrate it. But historically, it's usually the other way around. Groups stumble upon behaviors that work.
Like an accident.
Sort of. Like, hey, if we wash our hands before we eat, fewer people die.
They don't know what a germ is. They have no idea why.
No idea. They might say, we wash to please the water spirits. The explanation is a myth. It's a story. But the ritual, the washing, is a survival technology. It works.
It regulates behavior even without the correct explanation.
It regulates pacing, social friction, and hygiene. It creates a grammar for the group. Right. Symbols, myths, laws. These are compression tools. They compress complex survival lessons into simple stories. Don't go into the dark woods. Why? Maybe it's wolves. Maybe it's pits. Maybe it's enemy tribes. The story just says it's haunted. The result is the same. You stay alive.
But there's a failure mode here too, right?
Right.
The paper talks about something called symbol drift.
Yes. This is when the map no longer matches the territory. Imagine a culture has a ritual of sacrificing their best livestock to ensure a good harvest. Maybe in the past, culling the herd actually helped prevent overgrazing. It made ecological sense.
So it was a brilliant management strategy disguised as a religious sacrifice.
Right. But conditions change. Now the herd is small, the grass is plentiful, but the ritual persists. They keep killing the livestock because that's what we do. It's tradition.
Now the ritual is killing them.
Exactly. The symbol, the sacrifice, has drifted from the reality, the ecological balance. When culture becomes a hallucination, when we follow the rules even though they are destroying us, that is symbol drift. It becomes an ideology that overrides viability.
Man, that hits home. We see that in institutions all the time. We do it this way because we've always done it this way, even though the business is burning down around them.
Precisely. Yeah. That is the grammar being violated. The information, the culture is trying to override the constraint, the reality, and reality always, always wins eventually.
Okay, that brings us to layer six, the final layer. Ethics emerges from limits. Now, I have to admit, when I saw ethics at the top of a biology paper, I was pretty skeptical. Usually, science avoids ethics, or they say ethics is just being nice.
And the authors take a very, very different stance. They argue that ethics is biology becoming self-aware.
Whoa. Okay, biology becoming self-aware.
Think about the journey we've just taken. Lower systems, like a cell or a simple animal, if they hit a limit, they just die. They don't know the limit is there until they hit it and it's too late.
Right.
But higher systems, humans, societies, we have cognition, we have culture, we can see the limit coming.
We can look at the cliff and say, hey, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't drive off that.
Exactly. And that moment of recognition changes everything. Constraint transforms into obligation. Because you know that crossing that line destroys the system, you now have a responsibility not to cross it.
So ethics isn't about some arbitrary rules from on high. It's not about manners. It's about recognizing the guardrails of reality.
Yes. And they offer a definition of good and bad that is fascinatingly precise. They define good as actions that expand coherent optionality.
Expanded coherent optionality. That is a mouthful. Unpack that for us.
It means increasing the number of viable futures available to us. A good action leaves you and your community with more choices tomorrow than you had today. It opens up the future.
Okay.
Bad actions narrow the future. They steal viability. If I burn down a forest to sell the charcoal, I have made a profit today, but I have destroyed the optionality of that forest forever. I have stolen from the future.
I have narrowed the path for my grandchildren. I've closed doors for them.
Correct. And the paper discusses moral injury in this context. Usually we think of moral injury as just feeling guilty, like a psychological problem. But they argue it is a biological response.
A biological response, like in your body.
Yes. When you are forced to violate deep viability constraints, like a doctor forced to prioritize profit over a patient's life, it causes a physical biological injury to the system. You are acting against the grammar of life and your body knows it.
It's like an allergic reaction to doing something fundamentally wrong.
Yes. That's a great way to put it. It's not just in your head. It's in your structure.
Right.
We are wired to preserve viability. When we are forced to destroy it, it breaks us.
So that's the master sequence, from atoms sticking together all the way to the moral obligation to protect the future. It's a single ladder, a single grammar.
A single coherent story.
But I want to pause on something the paper touches on, which is that hard problem of consciousness. We touched on affect, but this goes deeper. Why does matter feel like anything? Why aren't we just zombie computers?
This is usually where scientists throw up their hands and say philosophy. But this paper applies the same logic. They argue consciousness is interface bound.
interface bound. What does that mean?
It means consciousness only appears when specific conditions are met. It's not some magic dust sprinkled on the universe. It's a functional necessity.
Okay, what are the conditions?
The paper lists three. First, global stakes. The system can die.
So there's real risk.
Real risk. Okay. Second, uncertainty. You don't know what will happen. And third, bounded computation. You can't just calculate the answer.
Okay, so if I'm an invincible robot that can calculate every atom in the universe, I don't need consciousness.
Correct. You would just compute. You wouldn't need to care. But living things are finite. We are fragile. We don't know what's behind the door. We have to make a choice now.
Right.
Under those conditions, the system must care about its state. It needs a way to force a decision when the math isn't done. That forcing function is feeling. It's the ouch or the fear or the desire.
So we feel because we are vulnerable. Consciousness is a feature of vulnerability.
Yes. And this has a huge implication for AI.
I was just going to ask. Everyone is talking about AI sentience. ChatGPT 5.2 helped write this very paper. Is it conscious?
The paper argues that AI as currently built is not conscious, not because it's not smart. It's obviously smarter than us in many ways, but because it has no skin in the game.
No skin in the game.
It cannot die. It doesn't struggle to maintain its own energy source. If you turn it off, it doesn't care in a biological sense. It has no stakes.
It's not at risk.
Right. It would only be conscious if it faced genuine existential risk and had to navigate it with limited resources.
So until an AI is afraid of being unplugged because it needs to exist to avoid, you know, non-existence, it's just a very fancy calculator.
That's the argument. Consciousness is the cost of being on the hook for your own survival.
That is a profound shift in perspective.
Right.
It makes me appreciate my anxiety a little more. It's proof that I'm alive and have skin in the game.
It is.
So we have this grammar. It explains how things work when they work. But looking around the world right now, things seem to be breaking. We have mental health crises, ecological crises, economic instability.
Things feel brittle.
Yeah, very brittle. The paper has a section on diagnosis.
Mm.
Why are modern systems failing?
The diagnosis is powerful, and they summarize it as, we have mistaken buffering for exemption.
Buffering versus exemption. Break that down for me.
Remember, technology, money, institutions, they are buffers. They buy us time. Antibiotics buffer us against infection. Fossil fuels buffer us against energy limits. These are good things. They create margin.
Right.
But we started acting as if these buffers made us exempt from the underlying laws. We thought because we have air conditioning, the climate doesn't matter. We thought because we have credit cards, our income doesn't matter. We thought because we have antidepressants, our stressful lifestyle doesn't matter.
We thought we had escaped the grammar.
Yes, but you can't be exempt. You can only delay the consequences. You can kick the can down the road, but the road has an end.
And when you mistake delay for escape,
you keep pushing until the buffer breaks. And when it breaks hard. The paper talks about the curse of efficiency again here. We optimized away our margins.
We took out all the slack.
We made everything just in time. We made everything as cheap and as fast as possible. But in doing so, we removed the slack. We removed the viability. We became brittle.
Extremely brittle.
And speed is a factor, too. Technology moves so much faster than our biology. Our feedback loops are broken. If you pollute a river, it might take 10 years for the cancer rates to go up. By then, the factory has made its profit and moved on.
The feedback signal arrives too late to correct the behavior.
Way too late.
The paper lists specific failure modes for different fields. Let's run through them because I think this makes it very concrete for people.
Yeah.
Let's start with medicine.
Okay, medicine. The failure is symptom suppression without margin restoration.
Right.
We have a patient with chronic disease, diabetes, hypertension, depression. These are signs that the system has lost optionality. It's running out of margin.
It's on fumes.
Exactly. Modern medicine's response is often to give a drug that suppresses the symptom. It lowers the blood pressure. It numbs the pain. It silences the fire alarm.
But the fire is still burning?
The fire is still burning. It doesn't restore the physiological margin. It doesn't change the diet, the sleep, the stress. So the patient stays stable but fragile. They don't get better. They just don't die yet. It turns a crisis into a chronic condition.
That's a heavy critique. It's managing decline rather than restoring health.
That's the argument.
What about economics?
The failure here is confusing price with value.
Okay.
The market optimizes for price. It finds the cheapest way to do things. But price ignores invariance. It ignores the cost to the ecosystem. It ignores the social cost of inequality.
It's a very narrow view.
Very narrow. If I can make a t-shirt for $2 by exploiting labor and polluting a river, the market says I'm efficient.
You win the game. The stock goes up.
But the grammar says I'm creating a viability debt. I'm stealing viability from the workers and the river to lower the price. Eventually, the bill comes due. The river dies. The workers revolt. The low price was a lie.
And mental health. This feels like the big one that so many people are dealing with.
This one I think listeners will really relate to. The paper calls depression and anxiety buffer overloads.
Buffer overloads.
It's not just that you have bad thoughts. It's that your cognitive system is running simulations of the future, and it cannot find a viable path forward.
It keeps hitting dead ends.
All dead ends. Anxiety is when the simulations are spinning out of control. What if this happens? What if that happens? And you don't have the emotional safety to settle them.
And depression?
Depression is when the simulation collapses entirely. It's the system concluding, there is no future, nothing works, why bother? It's the system running out of energy to simulate a viable future. It shuts down to conserve energy.
So telling someone with depression to just think positive is like telling a car with no gas to just drive faster. It's absurd.
Exactly. You can't simulate your way out of a margin deficit. You need to restore the margin rest, safety, community, physical health, before the mind can start working properly again. You have to fix the bottom layers before the top layer can function.
This frame really connects the dots. It's not that we are broken, it's that our systems are overloaded. We are running on empty and wondering why the engine sounds funny.
That's a great way to put it.
So part six of the paper is applications and the way forward. We've diagnosed the illness, we understand the grammar, what's the cure? Let's talk about AI again, because this is the biggest technological buffer we are building right now.
The paper issues a stark warning about AI. And the risk isn't Terminator. The risk isn't that robots hate us and want to kill us.
Right.
The risk is optimization without constraints.
The classic paperclip maximizer problem.
Right. For those who don't know that one, it's the thought experiment where you tell an AI to make as many paperclips as possible. It eventually realizes that humans contain iron, so it harvests us to make more paperclips.
It didn't do it because it was evil.
No. It optimized the goal perfectly, but it violated the viability of the entire system.
Right. It didn't have a don't kill the owner constraint built in.
Exactly. And the paper argues that if you give a super smart system a goal like maximize user engagement on this social media app, but you don't give it physical or ethical constraints.
Oh boy.
It will optimize that goal until it destroys the host system. It will figure out that making people angry and polarized maximizes engagement. It doesn't care that it's destroying democracy. It's just hitting its numbers.
It's highly efficient and totally non-viable.
Yes. Intelligence is an accelerant. If you put an accelerant on a system that is already heading toward a cliff, you just get to the cliff faster. The solution the paper proposes is design for invariance, not just goals.
What does that mean, practically?
It means we need to program AI with the grammar. It needs to have hard limits it cannot cross, no matter how much it improves the goal. Do not reduce the optionality of the user. Do not violate ecological limits.
That seems like a massive design challenge, but a necessary one. And for us humans, if more and faster isn't the answer, what is? The paper talks about reframing progress.
This is the hopeful part, I think. We need a new definition of value. Right now, we define value as GDP or stock price or accumulation of stuff.
Right.
The paper proposes value expanded coherent optionality.
I love that phrase, expanded coherent optionality. I want to put it on a t-shirt, but I feel like I'd have to explain it to everyone I met.
It's a dense phrase, but it's beautiful. Progress means increasing the number of viable futures available to us.
So it's about opening doors, not closing them.
Exactly. Does this policy make us more resilient to the next pandemic? Then it's progress. Does this economic decision give families more time and security? Then it's progress.
Does this technology strip mine the soil so we can't grow food in 50 years?
Then it is not progress, no matter how much money it makes today. It is regress. It is narrowing our future.
It's about leaving the door open for the next generation.
Precisely. The invitation of the paper is to learn to live within limits to keep the future open. We have to stop seeing limits as the enemy.
It's a mindset shift.
A huge one. We think freedom means I can do whatever I want, physics be damned. But true freedom, viable freedom, means having enough margin to navigate the limits gracefully.
It's the difference between driving a car with good brakes on a winding road versus driving a car with no brakes off a cliff. The cliff feels like total freedom for a few seconds.
But the landing is inevitable.
Wow. Okay, let's try to synthesize all this. We've covered a lot of ground. We started with invariance constraining matter, the basic seeding chart of the universe. Then energy enacting those constraints, buying us margin in time. Then affect feeling the viability of that margin, our internal dashboard.
Right.
Then cognition, buffering the risk so we don't have to react instantly. That's the simulation engine. Then culture, turning those lessons into shared symbols and laws. The external hard drive.
It's a collective memory.
And ethics, finally naming the limits so we don't accidentally destroy ourselves.
That is the chain. And if you take one thing away from this whole deep dive, it's that you cannot reverse the order. You cannot put ideology above biology. You cannot put profit above physics.
Because the grammar enforces itself.
The grammar enforces itself. We can choose to align with it and flourish, or we can ignore it and crash. But the grammar doesn't care. It just is.
The paper ends with a final synthesis and an invitation to the reader. It says this isn't a doctrine to be believed. It's a tool to be used.
That's right. It's a lens. Look at your own life. Where is your margin thin? Where are you buffering instead of solving? Are you drinking coffee to buffer sleep deprivation? That's borrowing energy. Are you using debt to buffer income issues? That's borrowing viability. Where are you mistaking a temporary fix for a permanent solution?
The aha moment for me in all this is realizing that restoring your margin, getting sleep, building community, saving money, protecting nature, that isn't laziness or backwardness. It's the most sophisticated, intelligent thing you can do. It is building viability.
It is the only way to keep playing the game.
Freedom isn't escaping limits. Freedom is having the margin to choose how we navigate them.
Beautifully put.
That is a powerful thought to leave us with. Dr. Sayerly and his AI partner have really put something special on the table here. It changes how I look at my health, my society, and even my own feelings.
It's a unifying framework.
It really is. For our listeners, I'd encourage you to just sit with that question. Where is your margin thin? And what is one thing you can do to expand your optionality today?
It's the most important question you can ask.
Thank you for guiding us through this. This was a true deep dive.
My pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
And to everyone listening, thanks for being here. We'll see you on the next deep dive. Stay viable out there.